Welcome to the Leadering Live series. In these half-hour recordings, we'll explore each of the key concepts from Nancy Giordano's new book, Leadering, The Ways Visionary Leaders Play Bigger, annotated with insights from global thought leaders. We'll discover how the structures put in place to reduce risk and drive success in the industrial era are now often the very things creating vulnerability in the 21st century, and why it's time to ditch the outdated playbook and radically shift our approach from static leadership to dynamic leadering. In this episode, Contribute versus Extract, we look at how, as environmental and societal breakdowns become more evident, it is no longer sustainable to simply extract resources for the benefit of a small number of investors or shareholders. Future business success will be dependent on contributing value to a much broader set of stakeholders, moving from CSR to SLO, or corporate social responsibility, to a social license to operate. Joining us is special guest Craig Dubitsky, Chief Innovation Strategist for Colgate-Palmolive and friendly founder of Hello Products, who is committed to regenerative solutions that are 100% good for us and good for the planet.
Chapter 5 is all about this conversation that we have around what is the role of business in a shifting society, as so many different externalities and sort of external breakdowns are becoming more visible. What really is the role? And so the book starts with a story that I think is worth repeating here, because I think it's a really good setup for the conversation that we're in. And it tells the story of two custodians. It was from a New York Times article a few years ago, and they compared and contrasted a custodian from back in the 80s, a woman named Gail, and a custodian now named Marta. So Gail worked full-time for Kodak. She started as a janitor, but because she was full-time employed, she had benefits. And she had, time off. I mean, she had sick leave and she had vacation and she also had tuition credits. And so she was able to invest in herself and she would take comp sci classes at night. And it turns out she had a real a huge aptitude for it. And it was right when that, technology was becoming, comp sci was becoming a bigger part of organizations. And so they recognized Gail's aptitude and they gave her more and more responsibilities. And eventually she rose. And I forgot exactly what her title was there, but I think it may have been like CTO of Kodak. She went on then to several other companies. And what was really interesting is I gave a talk to Mercer Global Investments in Canada 2 years ago. And it turns out that she's now their chief digital officer there. And I had no idea as I was telling this story. So that was her path. And then you compare it to Marta. So Marta now works for a custodial service that is an outsourced firm that Apple uses to clean Apple's offices in Cupertino. And because she is an outsourced employee, she and sort of this contingent work for. She has none of those benefits. She has no full-time guaranteed job employment. She has no vacation time. She has no sick leave. She has no tuition reimbursement. She has none of the support structures. And as a result, she will be stuck in that position and we're just sort of like unable to be able to advance. And so we talk about the fact that the pressure that's put on the middle class and the shrinking of the middle class and the increase in bipolar economy and wealth and education and health and all the other statistics that go with it, this is part of what is feeding it. It's part of the systemic problem. So the question becomes, should Apple be responsible for that or not? And the way I look at it and say, Apple did it that way because they wanted to focus on their core competency and take out all the various pieces of their business that they didn't want to be able to have to manage on a full-time basis and extract them, but which is fine. But then I would argue that it would be important for them to hire suppliers who live with that same set of ethics and encourage them and pay them at a rate in which they can sort of mimic some of the same port structures that existed then. And if it's not done inside organizations, then we have to figure it out as a society because we can't continue to kind of have this. So that's really what I think sets up a really good question around why things are shifting the way they are and how we've ended up in some of the positions that we are in. And then the question is, do we want to continue that way of working, the drive toward efficiency and the drive toward ROI and where we lose our humanity and our connection to one another, which is why this follows so well on the conversation we had previously about being connected versus alone and recognizing our relationship to one another. We do have a responsibility to one another. And there is a price to these externalities, right? If we look at them across just four, the book just takes it sort of in four giant buckets. So there's the environmental ones that have to do with climate stability and climate change. They're the ones that have to do with ecological health and well-being. Like, let's just talk about e-waste for a second. As I'm going back to the book, the amount of e-waste that we create is equal to, 350 cruise ships the size of Queen Mary? Like, is it every day or every year? It must have been every year, right? It can't possibly be every day. I'd say it's every year. But that's still a lot of e-waste that we are creating. So the fact that we've got not just an environmental issue, but we've also got an ecological issue, right? The amount of plastic in the ocean is going to overtake the number of fish that are in the ocean by weight within a few years. So if we really want our, you know, oceans to look like that, that just seems kind of horrifying. And then we've got, again, the growing bipolar wealth and income gaps that are associated, again, with health and education. And then the fourth is around technology and whether or not we think technology is holding us well or it's not. I call it when tech goes awry, what that would look like. So there's a lot of responsibility that happens there. And we can either look at those as pressures that make our businesses smaller, or we can look at those as opportunities that allow our businesses to grow. Emma just put a report, shared it with me yesterday. We'll figure out how to make it more visible. But that was done that showed that if we can get our handle on climate change and net zero waste in the sense that we create net zero structures in terms of our buildings and our cars and the way in which we manage energy, that it would be a $1 trillion economic opportunity by 2050. So the idea is, you know, do we want to keep paying for all the things that we keep messing up and having to sort of shore up in one way or another, or can we better prepare and better plan for it in a way that we actually then have an economic benefit? So we're really on the upside of all these things and say that it's not just about being altruistic or about being benevolent. This really is a huge business opportunity. And part of it is framing the business in a really different way. You know, Larry Fink, who was the CEO of BlackRock years ago, started talking about this in his investor newsletters, right? They're responsible for, I think, $6 trillion in investments, and was recognizing that the responsibility that corporations have in this landscape is really quite profound, and that it has a chance to, you know, to reshape everything if we do it differently. And then, you know, I will say BlackRock continues to be quite successful in the investment arena. They are not in any way becoming less so because they take this stance. And if anything, I think that Larry continues to be more confident about it and double down on it a bit more. One of the other influencers in this work for me was Indra Nooryi. So Indra, when she was CEO of PepsiCo, really shifted the way that they were thinking about it. She was really, again, a horizon leader who was thinking about the fact that they need to create, you know, better for you products. And got a lot of pushback from the bottlers and from the distribution sort of the business, who felt like she was going too far in that direction too fast, but she could see where it was all headed, and the obesity stats have not in any way gotten, you know, prettier, they're worse. And she could see cities like when the mayor, Bloomberg, when he was mayor of New York City, actually tried to sue the beverage companies for the fact that they would sell these big, huge, oversized drinks for, you know, just pennies more, so to seduce people to buy sugary drinks, and then ended up becoming a huge health hazard for the Cook County medical system. And it was estimated like $200 million worth of services that had to be provided because of obesity and heart disease and all the things that were related to the consumption of these beverages. So we're seeing the kind of circular effects of all this. But Indra, she was shifting things in there, really tried to shift the mindset away from this idea of that we do CSR. So that we, you know, make a lot of money in a certain way, and then we figure out how to transfer some of that value over here. I call it value transfer. To instead thinking a lot about how we make the money. In every single action we take, we have an opportunity to create value along the chain from every single piece of it, which is the part that is so much more both motivating, exciting, and certainly impactful. And I call that value creation. So this idea that we can go from value extraction to a little bit of value transfer to really move to value creation. That is all the work that I do on a strategic level when I get to go work with organizations, is shifting it to that mindset, to that place, and seeing the upside of that. Again, this is not just because we want to, you know, make sure we don't get called out for it, but that there's actually really, really huge business opportunities. So if you look at the landscape and say, okay, well, what are some of the business opportunities, right? If you think about in the world of food, there's food is going through a giant transformation, as you guys have heard me say. The dairies have been very unprepared for it. So as Borden goes into bankruptcy the same year, Beyond Meat, which is a plant-based alternative to protein, files for an IPO and becomes the most successful IPO of 2019. So what we're seeing is, if you can actually look at this and say, you know, and Beyond Meat has done all the, you know, forensics on their business and how it uses less water and less energy and all the things that it does to create a very satisfying alternative to protein that is done in a way that's much more extractive and uses way too many resources. So if we can actually go again to solve for the problem, it creates a tremendous business opportunity. Now you start to see some of the traditional meat companies start to explore that and become part of it as well, as opposed to ignore it. And it was actually interesting. I actually went to some of the dairy things and sort of looked at the predictions for the dairy industry like 10 years ago. And this was never on anyone's horizon. Like they never even remotely thought that plant-based milks would in any way threaten their industry. And instead now plant-based milks of all kind, oat, I think, is now overtaken almond, which has overtaken soy, which has overtaken pea, which has overtaken something else. But collectively, they sell more than dairy, cow dairy milk. So just shows you again, if we can pay attention to these externalities and start to think about them in a way that shows us the path forward, as opposed to ignore them, we've got a much better opportunity. Another example that we talk a lot about in the book is circular fashion. So I'll just do a quick shout out to Eileen Fisher, who's one of the very first people as a fashion designer to recognize the waste in the industry and the fact that there was this growing sort of underground market for used clothing. And so she thought, rather than just trying to sort of let them get all the economic value, she was one of the first to bring them into her retail stores. So she created Eileen Fisher Renew, and she was actually selling gently used clothing right next to new clothing in her store, which you imagine many people thought was a disastrous business decision to have made. And instead it turned out to be a very successful decision for her. And now cut all the way to this year, where IKEA is starting to do that now with the same thing with furniture and with spare parts for some of their furniture. So she was way ahead of the circular curve on that. But this whole conversation again about how we think about stewarding our resources and creating opportunities in regenerative systems becomes really the mandate, I think, for us moving forward. And I could just go through many, many more examples. But I think first we'll jump into this conversation with, actually, I'll just do one more. And just to throw and say again, what the reason to pay attention to this is so fold, and I'll close with the conversation about where I think technology plays a role in this. But I think what's actually really interesting, if you look at Sweden, that seems to be the country that has the most sort of forward-thinking perspective. So there's three examples from Sweden. One is a credit card that has a carbon budget attached to it, which means that everything I buy in that month gets carbon calculated. And when I make a really big purchase at some point, I hit my limit, my card stops working. And it literally has a pledge on the back about the fact that I'm here to help steward the resources of the planet in a more effective way. So it really speaks to the values that we talked about with Carl Horton many days ago about as a consumer or a shopper or a person on the planet, that I want my values to be aligned with what it is, the choices that I make. And we certainly see for millennials that that is a really key driver for business. So if you think about who the consumers or buyers of the future will be, right, it's important to be aligned. So you've got a credit card that does that. Second of all, they've got a store that fluctuates prices based on its carbon footprint of the product. So if the carbon footprint's higher, the price is higher. If the carbon footprint's lower, the price is lower, which is really an extraordinary thing. Again, challenges assumptions that we would actually roll that into the actual pricing that you would see, again, to incentivize, right, the healthier choice. And the last, that they've got a pop-up retailer right now that has a full battery of metrics that they look at in terms of sustainability. And it's not just environmental. It also looks to whether or not the company is locally owned and whether or not the profits are locally distributed. So we had this conversation recently, again, with Erica and her team from Belcor in Latin America, who's thinking about trying to grow more globally. And the question will be, yes, you can be, you know, a global player, but how are you treating, you know, the folks and investing resources back into the communities of which you are, quote unquote, extracting, you know, time, attention, and resources. So there's a lot more interesting calculus that goes around all that, which is why I'm excited then now to share with you guys Craig Dubitsky. Craig and I are both on an advisory council for something called Retail Tomorrow, which is an initiative of a retail association called GMDC. And I love the way that Craig always talks about his work. He has a long history. He was an arbitrager. He then started investing in products like Method and helped bring Method to market as an investor and a whole bunch of range of other products. But then he decided to jump into the oral care category, and he will explain a little bit why. He was the founder of Hello Products, which has been, you know, giantly successful. And just over a year ago, was merged with Colgate-Palmolive. He says he was not purchased by, he was merged with. And again, we'll describe more around that. So he's a super infectious, fascinating person to listen to, and then we'll kind of zoom it back out. But I think it's fun to spend 10 minutes with Craig.
This chapter, where we start talking about the need to contribute versus extract, it's not just about the fact that we're trying to fix breakdowns right? There's big business opportunities here by addressing ways of doing it in a way that's healthier and more sustainable.
Yes, doing well and doing good are not mutually exclusive. Right. And I'll tell you, because I get asked this a lot, they're like, okay, so you started this Hello thing, and I'm happy to talk about Hello all day long if you like, but, you know, oral care to me was very unfriendly. Everything about the positioning of oral care was based on fear and shame. Like, if you're not whitening, you're frightening, you're not going to get paid, you're not going to get laid, you know, you're not going to get the job that you interviewed for because you're reeking freaky, and you're not going to get kissed goodnight at the end of your big date. Like, it's all scary. The dentist is going to drill, fill, and bill you. You start flossing the week before your dentist appointment that you're 6 months late for. It's like, everything's bad. I looked at this stuff and I'm like, this is crazy. And it's very masculine and very aggressive. And I thought, what's the friendliest word I can think of? This is the most unfriendly category I've ever seen. It was Hello. So I trademarked Hello, and Hello became Hello. And we had fits and starts, and it's not easy. I started, it was me, three people, and a dog. And then we became two dogs, and then we had a few more people. And fast forward, we became the number one natural toothpaste and mouthwash in Walmart and in Target. Probably the only brand to launch in all doors of Whole Foods, where we first met, and all doors of Dollar General, a week apart.
Wow, that is very impressive. That's hugely impressive.
Yeah, and people are like, Dollar General, I'm like, you don't get it. You don't get it because you're being yucky about Dollar General. Dollar General is amazing. And my mission was, I want to make a better product for everyone. So I tell Walmart, oh my God, you know, it's vegan, it's cruelty-free, it's made in America. We grow our mint with fourth-generation women-owned farmers in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. Our paper for our boxes is FSC-certified paper. We don't kill more trees. We print with soy-based inks. And my dream, this is what I tell them in real time. I'm like, and my dream is to be here with you right now because I wanted to make a product for the 100%, not for the 1%. And I stress, I did not say for the 99%. I said for the 100%. And I said, you're Walmart. If you want to create low-cost health insurance for everybody in America, you could do it with your human capital, financial capital, scale, reach, everything. Like, there's nothing you can't do. So for me, yeah, Whole Foods, terrific. I'm going to go there. But I wanted to be here with you and launch in all doors so everybody could have a better product. I wanted to go to Dollar General because there are people who can't even get to a Walmart. And guess what? If you're shopping at Dollar General, like any parent, you want to get the most natural, effective, safe thing you can for your kids, and hopefully have enough money left over to buy my lollipop at the cash wrap. Long story short, we launched their number one selling oral care product, not natural or traditional, number one selling oral care product. We launched a deodorant there, natural deodorant, which is an amazing product. Number one natural deodorant, like, bam.
Are you saying there's a business question there around that? Is it the same product, priced the same way, or was there
Yes, we didn't, like, dumb it down, decontent it. Oh, let's take a few ounces out of it. Same product. Because it's not right. I hate that game. It's like, well, we're just going to make it a little less good. Or we're going to shrink it and charge the same. It's like, no, no. And people ask me, they're like, well, tell me about your corporate social responsibility platform. I'm like, you know what it is? It's making better stuff for everyone. That's what it is. It's not like I had to hire a consultant and tell them to come in and we're going to figure out how to do like a buy one, give one, and we're going to plant trees. Guess what? We do all that stuff anyway.
Right.
Like, it's great. That's like table stakes. The bigger idea, the ethos, is to marry ethics and aesthetics. And part of the ethic is to make sure everyone has better stuff.
Right. It's accessible.
Hello was growing at this crazy clip. We were bringing all the growth to the category. Like, it was just insane. And we had a lot of suitors. And we didn't just have suitors. We had, like, bidders, which is amazing. Very, very, very fortunate. I built this great team of people. We're like fans.
I think that you built something that was very, very valuable.
Yeah, it was really, really magic, right? So the people, it's the people. And what was so fascinating about Colgate was that, apart from the fact that they're the largest oral care company in the world, like by far, but what's really amazing is they operate in over 200 countries, and they're the single most penetrated brand on the planet. Nobody seems to know that, which is also part of the Colgate magic. 62% of every household in the world has Colgate in it. The company is incredible, not only because they have access to people all over the world, this amazing platform and great trust and great R&D and amazing manufacturing capabilities. Like, all their manufacturing facilities, this is another really cool data point. And the fact that, like, they just don't, they're not like braggarts. They don't, They just are very chill. All their factories are LEED certified. All of them.
Wow.
Like, big companies say, oh, our headquarters that we don't own that we rent, it's LEED certified. It's like, no, Colgate has factories that they own that they are all LEED certified. I think they're the only company in the world where all their manufacturing is LEED certified. Next thing you know, like within a couple of weeks, we made a product. Here, I have one in front of me. I got to work with my friend who's a global head of design, and we got to design this thing.
Wow.
And we made iconography so it could work anywhere, even if you're a non-English speaker.
Oh, that's so great.
And stamped in, debossed into every one, is a little something different. Like, I was like, I want when people open it to get, like, even a little present. Some of them just say thanks. Some of them have little emojis, but they're all different. And the only thing I really didn't get was I didn't want it to say donated by Colgate-Palmolive. I wanted it to say made and shared with love by Colgate-Palmolive. But I guess there were some legal rules around the definition of love, maybe. I don't know. But anyway, I'm kidding. But there was something, and they were like, no, we have to say this. Partnered with the World Health Organization. Gave away 26 and a half million bars of soap, $20 million worth of, like, in, you know, really high quality industrial level, fabulous cleaning products. And then another chunk of money all within like a few weeks. It was done all over the world. This wasn't like, oh, we're just going to do it. It was like, no, there's a bunch of different countries. It's amazing. And like, they were just like, this is a great idea. We're doing it. And there was no fanfare. There was no, like, well, how do we turn that into a marketing spin? What's our social play going to be about that? Should we be, you know, how are we going to put that on Instagram stories, or should we put it on LinkedIn? It was just like, no, we're doing it. Like, done. And I was like,
so this
yeah.
is the power, though, I think. So the reason I wanted to have this chat with you today is because, you know, you and I are both on the Retail Tomorrow Advisory Board. I mean, you've talked about this, right, with such enthusiasm and such sort of awe and respect for it that they've done. But the fact is, it shows that capacity to be able to do so much good, right?
Totally. The ability to and by the way, any big company could do that. Like, I always say at Hello, no one has sole dominion over good ideas at Hello. Like, I'm the founder, but I'm like, bring it. Like, I'm an idiot if I don't tap into the collective thinking and goodness of all the fabulous people that are here.
As you look at it now, a year in, and it's been a very, very weird year. It's not a traditional year, which we can all imagine. But you imagine now what's on the horizon and the advice that we could give to other people that are sitting inside organizations with, you know, 35,000 smart, brilliant,
sure.
caring people.
I always said that my job at Hello was to magnetize the place so that the coolest, smartest, best people could do their coolest, smartest, best work. And if they weren't excited by being able to do their coolest, smartest, best work, then they weren't a fit anyway, right? Like, then they were motivated by other things that weren't going to really, I think, help us change the world.
You play the game way bigger than just inside this organization, right? You've seen it across all of these industries and across all of these sort of organizations and retailers and everyone else. So what do you think they get stuck the most? What is the one thing that we think we can unlock for them?
That's a great question. I go back to don't be afraid. Like, my thing is, you know, politics, all this stuff, it's like it's a game and it's a drain and it's horrible. You should have no fear of failure. You should have fear of not trying, because if you don't try, you've already failed.
Okay.
So, like, what's the worst thing that happens? Someone's going to say, that's a terrible idea. You know what? For those people that say it's a terrible idea, you know, good luck to them. Like,
right,
who cares?
Right.
Right? So I tell people, if they ask this type of question, what, like, you're a good person, you're an ethical person, you're an educated person, you don't mean anything, but, you know, you're well-intentioned. Do as much work as you can to figure out, if you have an idea, like, do all the research you can. Like, try to build a case so that when someone sees your idea or hears about it, they go, like, holy shit. Like, my favorite word is finally. I love finally. I love when someone sees something, they're like, finally, like, somebody got that right. Wow, we never thought about that before. What took so long? Why did we never think of that? Why didn't we create a friendly oral care company? Why didn't we trademark the word, you know, friendly and just do that? Like, why didn't we do it? And by the way, if your place that you work at says no, call me. You know, 917-392-1000. That's my cell phone. Call me up.
Well, you have to be careful, because I will say, after I go give keynote talks, Craig, I get a lot of people come up to me afterwards and want, like, I'm sort of the patron saint of what I call the island of misfit toys, the people inside organizations who have these ideas and constantly get told no.
Nothing worse than feeling like this intense level of passion where every day this thing is burning a hole in your psyche and you can't make it real. Like, that's a horrible feeling. I was introduced to this really interesting guy named Patrick McGinnis, who is the person credited with having created the term FOMO. And, you know, he has this whole thing about FOMO. And anyway, we were talking. He did this chat with me. And I said, you know, I don't think it's about FOMO. I think it's about font. And he's like, what's that? And I said, fear of not trying. So just, yeah, my advice to anybody is just try.
Yeah,
just try.
I love
it. That's the worst thing that happens. You're going to learn a lot. You'll feel good that you went for it.
That's a clumsy end to a very profound thing. And Laura, I am moved that you are moved, because when I had this conversation with Craig and we were editing this, you were the person I was thinking so much about in terms of this whole thing. And so I'm so, so glad that you are here and you get to hear and you to give his phone number out, Missy. So.
I was like, I didn't write it fast enough.
I'll have to with him in New Jersey. But I just think that he is just so, you know, he just brings such purity to this whole thing. And the part that was just slightly missing in the interview is that the hand soap was done in response to the pandemic. And all these things that were going around, he sent a note to, you know, a couple of people that were high in him. He's, you know, he's a pretty senior person. He's like, I'm connected to some senior people. He just sent this note, hey, there's this worldwide crisis going, what can we do? And within literally weeks, they had these 26 million bars of soap that were created and distributed for free. Which is part of what he talks about. Again, you can be an entrepreneur on the edge, but when you are inside an organization of that size and that scale, the amount of good that can be done if people just think to do it, and they have people inside the organization that are able to push that forward. So that's really what we're trying to do, is unlock that. But it's not just, again, to be altruistic. It is about building trust. If you really look at the horizon and say, where is it that business needs? What does the future need and expect of us? It is to build companies that are trustworthy and that we want to do business with, either as talent inside or outside the organization, as investors, as a community. We're going to care more about this. All the way around, we're going to need to draw resources to us and have support. And the thing that we didn't really get a chance to talk about is the shift again from CSR to CSLA, which I would call a social license to operate. And Mark, this goes a bit more into your terrain around the legal side of it, but it's not so much even a legal structure. It's just a sense of the fact that the community will say, we want you to do business here and with us because we, right, you know, we respect the way that you are stewarding resources. And when you don't, we will, you know, call you out. And there is a liability to that. You go around right now, what's happening with McKinsey? You can talk about what's happening with Purdue. The city of Charleston is suing the petroleum industry for, you know, hiding the fact that the ocean levels are going to rise and that their city is under threat. Like, there is really a cost to not doing business well. And so the whole question is whether or not we would like to continue paying those costs down the road, or whether or not we'd like to just, you know, invest in the things that we can invest in now in order to build a much more thriving and profitable and successful and productive future. And that's really, you know, and I'm here to champion in every possible way that I can, but that is the much better move to make. So with that, I'll just end up with one quote I have, like, not read from my book yet, but I will actually read, which is a very unflattering visual, but it leads to tomorrow, which is the CEO of IKEA, whose name I cannot pronounce, but says of their commitment, through our size and reach, we have the opportunity to inspire and enable more than 1 billion people to live better lives within the limits of the planet. We are committed to taking the lead, working together with everyone from raw material suppliers all the way up to our customers and partners.